This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After spending 4 years as the Washington Post's Moscow bureau chiefs from 2001 to 2004, my guests Peter Baker and Susan Glasser have a very interesting fix on Vladimir Putin and Russian politics and culture. Baker and Glasser, who are married to each other, have written a new book called Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of Revolution. Baker is now a White House correspondent for the Post. Glasser covers terrorism for the Post. Peter Baker, Susan Glasser, welcome to Fresh Air. How would you describe Putin's style of leadership now? I mean, it's not democracy. On the other hand, it's not communism.
Well, I think in a way we're looking at something that people have characterized as neo-Soviet rather than Soviet. It's very much a country in between run by Vladimir Putin, and the system that he has constructed is very much an updated, retooled for the internet era sort of authoritarian system run by the Kremlin.
How's authoritarianism retooled for the internet era?
Well, I mean, I think what that means is that, you know, you could call it kinder, gentler, or at the very least more sophisticated way of controlling events. In other words, you don't need to arrest everyone who tells a joke about the leader in the Kremlin. You don't shut down the internet. You don't close the borders. People are free to travel, to live, to work. But the pressure point, any potential space for political opposition, for dissent, is what the Kremlin has been paying the most attention to over the last 4 years as it's reconstructed a new system of centralized state control.
Peter Baker, what comes under that category of dissent, the kind of dissent that that Putin's administration has been cracking down on?
Well, they don't want to see dissent on television in particular. That's the most important thing. Vladimir Putin came into office because of manipulation of television, what they call Project Putin. That's what the Yeltsin people termed their campaign to install a little-known mid-level KGB officer. And because he came in through television, he realized that television was the main instrument of power in this new Russia. So the very first thing he did, in effect, was to take over television. He used to go home at night, bring home videotapes of that evening's news, watch it, and then come back to the Kremlin the next day and give them his judgments. And soon enough, within a year or so of his taking office, all state television, all national television, was now under state control.
And how has he changed the election process to produce the results he's wanted?
Well, that's also been very important. Obviously, television drives elections because you only see the candidates they want you to see. But they've also created what Lilia Shevtsova, an analyst in Moscow, calls imitation democracy. They have, you know, campaigns and ballot boxes. People dutifully go to the polls and cast their ballots. But in fact, if they have in a race a candidate who is a threat to them in any way, they managed to find a way to knock them off the ballot by some sort of phony court challenge, or they use the what they call administrative resources of the state to prevent him from giving speeches or to make his life difficult, or they find tax charges. That's one of the favorites they use these days to go after people who seem to be a threat against them.
Well, Putin actually canceled gubernatorial elections. When did he do it, and what was his excuse for doing it?
Well, in a way, we see this as one of the signal events, really, of the Putin era, and really sort of the end of the counter-revolution, the definitive end of the democratic experiment started by Boris Yeltsin. Because what President Putin did was really extraordinary. He took something that they had been planning in the Kremlin for months and even talking about for years, which was canceling gubernatorial elections. And they used the pretext of the terrible massacre of school children in Beslan, in southern Russia, right near Chechnya. And President Putin used the excuse of that and said, well, therefore, to combat terrorism, it's necessary for me to cancel elections in all 89 regions of Russia. Now, what canceling gubernatorial elections in far Siberia would have to do with cracking down on the threat from separatist fighters and terrorists in Chechnya is very unclear even to the Russian people. But it was a sign, I think, of how Project Putin had succeeded over the last 4.5 years, that even opposition from governors was not made publicly, because by that point it had already become, in effect, too dangerous, and they were more interested in keeping their jobs than in speaking out publicly against such a move.
So what did it accomplish for Putin to cancel the gubernatorial elections?
Well, it helped create what he calls a vertical of power. It, in Putin's mind, everything flows from the top. It's a monopoly of power in which everybody answers ultimately to him and the Kremlin. So he appoints these governors subject to the confirmation of the regional legislatures, but that's really a formality. And now they have to answer to him in a much more direct way. They already did in an indirect way because he had managed to sort of emasculate some of their powers over the preceding several years. But then he just basically got rid of the fiction that they were an independent source of political power in Russia and made them subservient to him. He's also, of course, gone after the business community in the same way. He's gone after parliament, in effect, the same way. Any source of independent power in Russia had to be tamed or eliminated.
What do you think motivates Putin? Is it just the sheer desire for power? Is it ideology?
Well, you have to understand where Putin comes from. He grew up, of course, in what was then Leningrad, in a poor family, the grandson of Stalin's cook. You know, he was a childhood hooligan, frankly, in his own words, a tough who got into fights in the streets all the time until he sort of matured a little bit in his teenage years and realized that watching spy movies and reading spy books, that was the future for him. He really began to idolize the KGB. At age 15, he showed up at the local KGB recruiting office in Leningrad and said, you know, I'd like to join up. And the rather indulgent officer said, yes, son, but, you know, you don't come to us. If we want you, we'll come for you. And they did eventually. So his outlook is very much shaped by his experience as a KGB officer for 16 years. He served in the Secret Service. He never saw, in any of the interviews he's given, anything wrong done by the KGB. The persecution of dissidents, the Great Terror, none of these things ever has been indicated in his public discourse as a problem with the institution he helped serve. He, in fact, sees it as an institution in service of the state. And so his view is shaped by that, and what he wants to do is rebuild that state, rebuild the Great Russia that used to be, again, not the Soviet Union necessarily, but just the idea of a power in the world and a power at home.
You know, I find it interesting that Putin was motivated to join the KGB because he loved spy books. And I'm thinking, in the United States, all those spy books of the Cold War era, you know, the KGB, they were the villains. They were demonic. You know, who'd want to join the KGB based on American spy fiction? What spy books was he reading?
Well, they're not the villains, obviously, in the era that he grew up in. They're not even the villains today to many Russians.
Was there a lot of spy fiction in Russia when he was growing up?
Uh-huh. And what's really interesting is you'll see a lot of it now coming back on Russian television. It wasn't there for about 10 years. In the last few years now, you're seeing a revival of Soviet-era spy novels, spy books, spy fiction, and that sort of thing. The one that particularly influenced Putin was called The Sword and the Shield. It was about a heroic Soviet agent who was undercover in Nazi Germany. And he really idolized the hero of that, a guy named Yogan Weiss. That was the character. And in fact, this character in the series of The Sword and the Shield once said, "My ambition is to have as few people as possible in order to order me around and have the right to command as many as possible." Ironically, then, when Putin became president, he told Russian interviewers something that almost sounded exactly the same thing. Somebody asked him, and a Russian journalist asked him, "What's the difference now that you're in the Kremlin?" He says, "In the Kremlin, I have a different position. Nobody controls me here. I control everybody myself." So this was a very formative period for Putin.
Did you have any personal meetings with Putin?
We did. Each of us interviewed him on a couple of occasions along with other American correspondents, both in the Kremlin and his private dacha or his residence outside of Moscow.
Yeah, he's a very, very poised, very articulate, and very, very skilled at reading and memorizing, it appears, his briefing book. The thing that is most striking when you meet Putin in person is his ability to answer in long, long sentences and paragraphs that go on forever. He's almost Castro-like in his ability to speak for hours and hours. The first group interview that we had, American correspondents had with Vladimir Putin, was in 2001, not long after his famous summit with President Bush, when President Bush declared that he had taken the measure of Putin's soul and found it to be worth looking into. And right after that meeting, Putin invited us to the Kremlin library for a long session. We were kept waiting for several hours, and then once the interview began, it just never stopped. It went on and on and on, past midnight, actually, on a weeknight. And this is, as we were soon to learn, sort of a trademark Vladimir Putin performance.
I had another one that lasted almost 4 hours.
Wow.
4 hours of talking. Imagine President Bush or any American president talking to interviewers for 4 hours.
Now, that might sound like a really great thing, but on the other hand, that could be, just as an interviewer, I know that could actually be the sign of something really bad, which is that sometimes guests will like talk and talk and talk and talk, and you can hardly get a word or a question in, and what they're saying isn't necessarily interesting or revealing. It's just a barrage of words. So
that's right.
No, it was a very grueling enterprise, absolutely. But, you know, there were a few revealing things that we saw consistently with Putin when he did meet with the press. And one of the most interesting things was that this is a very cool character by most accounts. You know, he's a very disciplined guy. He's into, you know, the Eastern martial arts. He's a very tough, calm, controlled guy. The one thing that consistently made him almost furiously, madly angry were questions about the conduct of the war in Chechnya. And then you would see a completely different character take over. His face would literally change, and he would get very angry. He would reprove me. Twice I asked him about Chechnya in group interviews, and he got very angry, and he said, you know, we've told you again and again. Once in a press conference in Western Europe, he actually threatened a forced circumcision of a French reporter who dared to ask him about human rights abuses in Chechnya. And the translator was so shocked that the translator did not actually translate that part of Putin's answer. And the European diplomats who were sharing the stage with him therefore didn't even know until afterwards that Putin had made such a very crude remark. And it took like a whole day for it to become clear. So he's a guy with a real temper, and that did come out in these sessions.
The first time President Bush met President Putin, President Bush said that he was able to get a sense of Putin's soul. And one of his connections to Putin, one of the things that he really connected to about Putin, was that Putin was wearing a cross. Now, apparently, President Bush made a false assumption in his interpretation of this, and you tell the story in your book. Would you tell us the story of Putin's cross?
Well, President Bush attached great meaning to this story. When they met in Slovenia for the first time, Bush had clearly been briefed a little bit about some of Putin's history. And he brought up this story that Putin had told interviewers about how his mother had secretly baptized him during Soviet times and how she'd given him this cross that he had kept with him. And Bush was very impressed by this and asked Putin about it. And Putin says, yes, yes, this is true. This is true. And then Putin tried to turn the conversation then on to Soviet debt. But Bush wanted to keep on this conversation track for a little bit, and it seemed to obviously impress him. Now, mind you, President Putin, for as important as this cross was supposedly to him, didn't actually have the cross with him. But he understood that this was important to President Bush, and so he elaborated on this in their meeting. And then at their next meeting in Genoa in Italy, Putin made sure to bring the cross this time, and he showed it to President Bush. See, here's the cross that we had talked about. President Putin even told him a story about how once when his own dacha burned to the ground, the one thing that he wanted to make sure was saved was this cross. Now, it's debatable, actually, how religious President Putin really is. There are some people, including some of our colleagues, fellow journalists, who believe he is quite religious, but he made very little public show of that in any real way. In an interview once with the Wall Street Journal, he was asked if he was religious, and he sort of hemmed and hawed and basically didn't answer the question. So, you know, but he understood as a former KGB officer what's important to the other person across the table from him, and he understood that was important to President Bush.
The presidencies of George W. Bush and Vladimir Putin have been defined in a lot of ways by terrorism. Before we talk about how Putin's administration has been defined by terrorism, would you just like briefly remind us of the two biggest terrorist incidents in Russia during the Putin administration, the one at the theater and the one at the school?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, in many ways, Putin's presidency has been defined from the very beginning by the war over the separatist Southern Republic of Chechnya, which is a majority Muslim republic, historically part of the Russian Empire since the late 18th century. And basically, there's been, you know, sort of on and off fighting ever since. And, you know, what's happened is that you've seen the marriage, basically, of that separatist movement with the sort of broader global Islamic extremists, and that has resulted in two particularly horrific mass terrorist events in Putin's presidency. In 2002, in October, a group of heavily armed Chechen rebels took a Moscow theater hostage in the middle of the showing of a popular musical called Nordost. 900 people were taken hostage, and I'm sure your listeners all remember the terrible ending to that siege, in which 129 people were killed when the Russian special forces stormed the theater and they used a mystery knockout gas in order to accomplish that seizure. And unfortunately, the rescue effort was botched. The doctors didn't even know what kind of gas had been used, and 129 of the hostages died, almost all of them, according to the doctors, from the botched efforts of the gas. And then fast forward a couple years later, last September, in Beslan, Russia, on the border nearby with Chechnya, the first day of school, all the children in their best outfits, and they're lined up for the beginning of school assembly. They're just finishing that. And again, a band of Chechen rebels and fighters from neighboring republics pulls up in military trucks. They storm in to the school. They take it hostage, and there's a terrible denouement 2 days later, and, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of children, their teachers and parents, were killed in this small town in southern Russia.
Now, Putin told his share of lies around these terrorist incidents. What were some of the lies that he told?
Well, basically, the Russians would give out misinformation all along the way. In Beslan, for instance, the most recent one, the school, they said that they lied about how many people were caught in the building, basically. They didn't want to admit that there were 1,200 children and parents and teachers trapped in this building under hostage. They said it was something like 300 and some people. And the parents and the people in the town, they knew this wasn't true. They were so angry. And I think that sort of, you know, galvanized the people down there to be angry at their own government as much as they were at the people, the cruel and brutal people who had taken their children hostage. They lied about so many things in the Nordost thing as well. They first of all wouldn't tell us anybody what the gas was, and they said that everybody who died there died of previous complications of their health or things like that. The death certificates that were issued for the people who died from the gas were either left blank or they're under cause of death, or it would put something like terrorist incident, which of course wasn't true.
Well, I think what we found is that both of these incidents ended up sort of crystallizing what kind of a system President Putin had constructed. In particular, in Beslan, I was so struck by what happened during the final culminating battle, which raged for the most part of a day. And, you know, at the time that happened, and there were loud bombs basically that went off, which triggered this fighting. And both sides to this day, there's some recriminations as to what really happened. But CNN and BBC went live. That meant that viewers around the world could see this horrible struggle taking place in the school. And, you know, you could see live some of the most powerful and gut-wrenching pictures I've ever seen in my life of burned and bloodied and dead children being carried by the townsmen out of the building. And on Russian state television, because the Kremlin was silent and there were no orders on what to say and what the official line was, they ran soap operas. And what that meant was that the Russian people had soap operas and the rest of the world saw what was taking place in this Russian school. And to me, this was just such a poignant and sad reminder of the nature of political discussion in Putin's Russia, which was that it wasn't allowed. In the absence of instructions, it was safer to run a soap opera than to allow the Russian people to see their children being killed.
The 90s seemed to be about the rise of the big business moguls in Russia and the rise of the Russian mafia. Are those days over?
Yes and no. You're not going to see the sort of no-holds-barred gangland murders and that sort of thing that you saw in the 90s.
Although now, that did happen right around the corner from us at the local sushi joint, but that's a different story.
Right, but it's not as pervasive. It's not as it does still happen. There's still crime in New York, but it's not as pervasive. It's not sort of what runs the country the way. But it's still a very corrupt country, and you still have a very, very select group of people who have billions of dollars who are, in fact, getting wealthier every day. Putin has not destroyed the oligarchy, as they called these tycoons from the 1990s, simply because he put Mikhail Khodorkovsky in jail or drove Vladimir Gusinsky and Boris Berezovsky out of the country. He simply created his own oligarchy, an oligarchy that's loyal to him. Today there are something, as of a year ago, I've forgotten the current number, but as of a year ago, there are 33 billionaires living in Moscow, more than in any city in the world, more than in New York. I think that number's gone down a few because a number of them now are in jail or have fled the country. But there's still great wealth among a very select number of people in Russia. So that system has not been destroyed. It's simply been co-opted.
In your new book, you profile several people whose stories reflect how Russia is changing. And one of the people you write about is Mikhail Kozyrev, who was hired by Boris Berezovsky and Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox News, FX, The New York Post, Europe's Sky News. Mikhail Kozyrev was hired to start a new radio network. First of all, I didn't know that the Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky had partnered with Rupert Murdoch to start a radio station in Russia.
Strange bedfellows, huh?
Well, that's right. It's a little-known tale, and they certainly didn't want to make a big deal of that in Russia, where Berezovsky has been exiled. Basically, he helped bring Putin to power. He was a key advisor, in the inner circle of the Yeltsin era. He helped bring Putin, this obscure, unknown guy, literally 2% in the polls when they started out. And he made him president. And then he had a falling out with Putin, and he's been living in, self-imposed exile in Britain ever since. And yes, he was the one who started this radio station.
How did they come up with the format for the station?
Well, this is really a fascinating to me look at the fertile ground that existed for Vladimir Putin to come to power and take advantage of. Because basically, there was, by the end of the 1990s, a general fatigue, a sense that all things Russian were bad, a rejection of, everything about the Soviet Union and Russia that was all thrown out. Everything Western was good, eat Snickers, forget about our bad Soviet chocolate. That was the idea that existed in popular culture, in marketing, basically in every sphere of public life. And, people were tired of that. By the end of the 1990s, they felt that they hadn't necessarily gotten anything good out of that. So the ground was laid for sort of resurgent patriotism, even nationalism. And that's where this radio station comes in. And they used the techniques of Western marketing. They did a bunch of focus groups. They wanted to start a radio station. And they tested three formats. Two of them were Western pop music type formats. The third was all Russian music for the Russians, very patriotic. The idea was nationalism. And that's the one that tested off the charts. And they decided to go with Russian music for the Russians.
And you say that Kozyrev, who was running the station, ended up being accused of flirting with Russia's demons of racial hatred, mindless chauvinism, and subservience to dictatorship. How was that reflected in the music?
Well, I think Misha Kozyrev found that to have a patriotic Russian radio station was not nearly as simple as he thought, and he immediately found himself sort of in the swamp of modern Russian politics. And, there was this whole cadre of sort of underground dissident rock groups in the 1980s that he had grown up listening to on secretly passed around tapes that they called Magnitsadat, in homage to the secret books that were called Samizdat. And he really worshipped these groups. They helped inspire basically a whole generation, sort of the Russian Gen X, against the Soviet state. And many of these groups were based in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. But what happened to them was that as they experienced the fall of the Soviet Union and the new Russia, many of them turned to outright racism or chauvinism. For example, one of the groups that Misha Kozarev had particularly loved when he was growing up in the 1980s was a band called Alisa. They were just absolutely drove the Soviet authorities crazy. They had an anthem called My Generation that was probably the most popular of all the underground songs of the 1980s, really sort of an underground Beatles, they were. And what happened was they became complete hardliners, far, far right nationalists over the course of the 1990s. In the year 2000, Kinchev, the frontman for this group, released a hit album that was called Sonseverot that had a big swastika on the cover. And Misha Kozarev decided that, you know, that wasn't acceptable for his radio station and he wouldn't play it. But there were many other songs and albums that did appeal really to the darker side of the new Russian that he did end up playing and becoming very popular on his radio station.
Is the station still on?
The station is still on. It's quite popular. It's sort of a Russian alternative rock station, but it has a lot of imitators and a lot of more mass market type patriotic stations that have succeeded even more. Basically, he came up with the formula and other people improved upon it, made it more mass market, and were willing to make compromises that this guy was not.
So I mean, do you think of it as still being chauvinistic and expressing racial hatreds?
I think that that's a constant problem, really, for them, is what kind of Russian music do they want to play and how has the society shifted? And many of the popular underground groups of the 2000s, for example, these days are groups that are very anti-American. You know, there was even a hit song in the clubs a couple years ago called Kill the Americans that was a very popular group. And that is who the audience is for this radio station.
That song's a hit in a lot of countries now, isn't it?
Different variants on the same theme, yeah. I'm afraid.
Well, listen, now that Putin's Russia is no longer really a democracy, do you think that Russia might be a threat again to the United States at any point?
Well, certainly serving its own interests, and we shouldn't, Americans need to be understanding the fact that Russia is going to look out after its own interests first. There was a competition, in effect, in Ukraine last winter, between Russia and the United States. Russia very actively, Putin very intrusively tried to shape and mold that election the same way he had in his own country. And Ukrainians rejected that. They turned out in the streets in massive numbers to say that they were not going to stand for a stolen election. The United States did not participate nearly as directly, but it did fund NGOs, non-governmental organizations that trained activists to fight for civil society, how to run political campaigns and the like. And so it became a real sort of almost Cold War style confrontation for at least a few days and weeks. Now, that's not going to happen a lot all the time. There is an interest in both capitals at the moment in keeping the relationship good. But Putin wants to make Russia a great country again, a power if not a superpower. And you have to remember, of course, Russia is still the only country in the world with enough nuclear weapons other than us to destroy the entire world in a space of 20 minutes. It's still the only country in the world that borders or comes close to all of the other axis of evil countries, if you will. They're neighbors with North Korea. They're right next to Iran. They're right next to Syria, Iraq. They have funded and helped and aided many of these countries in the past. There are people in Russia, even if the government isn't, who continue to help these countries. So they're a more assertive, a more neo-imperialistic Russia poses a challenge for the United States if the relationship isn't managed.
You know how in the United States a lot of Americans are fighting about interpretations of America's recent history, the Vietnam War, the meaning of Watergate, the meaning of Deep Throat. Is Russia fighting about its history, about the meaning of communism?
Absolutely. This is one of the the third rails of modern Russian politics is very much about history and competing interpretations of it. And I think from the very start of our tour in Russia, we were shocked to find really radically alternate history than here in the West. There's this great narrative, right? You know, the Berlin Wall falls, freedom comes to Russia, yay, democracy, done, closed chapter. And I think what really happened, while to a certain extent the world's attention was focused elsewhere, especially since September 11th, was that a competing vision of history has taken hold in Russia. And it's very different than the one that most of your listeners would be familiar with about modern Russian history. In this version of history, which we were to hear again and again, the collapse of the Soviet Union was not a great victory for freedom and democracy, but in fact, the reverse. It signaled the beginning of chaos and catastrophe and an era of dangerous dislocations. President Putin himself, during his one and only campaign speech of his re-election last year, called it a national tragedy on a colossal scale, the breakup of the Soviet Union, which is a very radically different interpretation of the fall of the Soviet Union than the one that we hear in Washington.
And just last month, in fact, elaborated on that theory in a State of the Nation address. He called it, in fact, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, the fall of the Soviet Union. That's a rather extraordinary...
Completely ignoring the terrible consequences of Stalinism in his own country, of the Holocaust, World War II, a very dramatic historical statement and battle is being fought. And actually, I was so interested in this question of what kind of history was being shaped and presented to Russians today that I decided to spend a year going to an 11th grade Russian history class in a school in Moscow. And what I found was very surprising to me as I attended these classes. I expected sort of maybe an old-style teacher and a new generation that was very uninterested in the Soviet Union, that really wanted to move forward, that would be basically the first capitalist generation, the first democratic generation. And that's not at all what I found in a school on the outskirts of Moscow. Instead, as I went there over the course of the year, what I saw was a group of students who had been told by their disillusioned parents that the Soviet Union had really been the source of all greatness in Russian life, and that it was only in the 1990s that the country had begun to suffer. And these kids were too young to remember themselves, whereas their teacher was constantly trying to remind them of the costs and the human toll of living in a dictatorship, which she remembered. But the students wanted to live in a great country, and they identified greatness with the Soviet Union from the very first day, in which the teacher asked the students to raise their hand. She asked them, which side would you have been on in the revolution in 1917? And the largest number of students raised their hand, and they said, Lenin. The Bolsheviks were right.
Have you heard any Russian rationalizations, either from Putin's administration or from people who you met, rationalizations for the mass imprisonments of people during the Soviet era, rationalizations for the Gulag?
Well, what's most interesting is that people now acknowledge that fact, which they didn't even as recently as 15 years ago. We had colleagues we worked with in our office in the Washington Post in Moscow, who are the exact same age as Peter and I, and had been told nothing in school as recently as the early and mid-80s about Stalinism and the Gulag. So in that sense, today's students are aware of those horrific abuses, but it tends to be dismissed with a shrug of the shoulders and a sort of, well, this isn't 1937. In fact, when I was interviewing people in the city of Ivanovo about President Putin before his re-election, I asked them if they were concerned about the rising authoritarian trend in society, the rollback of freedoms that I figured that they would appreciate very much, since these were slightly older people. And, they're very cynical people about politics, I think, having been so ill-served by a succession of leaders. Most of the Russian people I met would just sort of shrug and throw up their hands. And that's what these people did in Ivanovo. They looked at me and they said, well, in any event, it won't be dictatorship like Stalin. And so there's a real desire in society to close the book on that, to excuse it as not the product of a system, but as some sort of terrible aberration in 1937.
And you have to remember that Stalin looks different to Russians than he does to us. We, in America and the West, Stalin is put in the same category perhaps as Hitler, and there's certainly by the death toll a comparison to be made. In Russia today, you know, polls will show that as many as 25% of Russians say they would vote for Stalin tomorrow for president of Russia. That's an extraordinary thing. Imagine if that were true in Germany, it would be an international outrage. We would walk down the streets of the old Arbat, and you'd see in these touristy shops, you know, selling vases with Stalin's picture on it. And you'd go to the May Day celebration, you still see all these old folks with, you know, Stalin signs and so forth. We had a dinner party once. It's not just relegated, though, to the older folks. We had a dinner party once with some friends, including a Russian, and the point of Stalin came up in the conversation, and she said, look, you know, Stalin wasn't so bad, the USSR wasn't so bad, you know, and we said, well, how will you think Stalin will be viewed in history? She says, I think he's going to be viewed as a hero. He got us through World War II. So even among young people, this is still the view today among a certain part of the population.
The subject of anonymous sources has been on a lot of people's minds right now between the Deep Throat revelation and the Newsweek retraction of the story of a guard at Guantanamo flushing a Koran down the toilet. So I'm interested in what you think of anonymous sources and how they should be used, since, you know, you worked in Russia, where I'm sure there's a lot of people who are still uncomfortable talking to the press. I mean, people were terrified to talk to the press during the communist era because they could have been put in prison for that. And now, you know, Susan, you're covering terrorism, and Peter, you're covering the White House. And I'm sure, you know, I know those are subjects in which there are typically a lot of people who are willing to talk, but not on the record. And you both work at the Washington Post. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about the relative importance of anonymous sources and how you think they should and should not be used.
Well, I think obviously anonymous sources is a big issue. It should be a big issue in our industry, and I think it's healthy to talk about whether they're overused. Actually, studies have shown that in American media, they've actually gone down since Watergate, the number of anonymous sources cited in the major media. But I think they still should be used as sparingly as possible, and we probably all have failed to be as rigorous as we ought to be in excising them from our stories. In Russia, you're right, it's interesting, the consequences of speaking in Russia as opposed to America, if you're outside of the political accepted dialogue, are more severe. At one point, we were writing about this case involving the oil tycoon who was jailed and how they were trying to take away his company. And the head of the union of oligarchs, one of the most, you know, prestigious men in the country, certainly a man of means and prosperity and not somebody who had much to worry about, told Russian television, I see who's behind this move. He says, but I'm very scared to name names now. I have 6 grandchildren and I want them to be alive. Now, that's somebody who has a reason maybe to be anonymous. And in America, you know, the consequences of speaking out on the record are far less dire most of the time. And therefore, we ought to find ways of remembering that and pushing our sources to be, if not even on the record, at least more explicit about where they come from. You know, if you can't say what official, at least try to say White House official as opposed to say administration official, but that's something the Bush administration always insists on. If you want to say a congressional official, try to say at least Democratic source on the Judiciary Committee or something like that. Try to be as open as you possibly can with the readers, but it's something we all need to be constantly vigilant about.
Do you think if people have to identify themselves as a White House official as opposed to just an administration official, that they'll be less secure coming forward and more afraid that they won't remain anonymous and that they'll lose their job? And even though losing your job isn't like being sent to the gulag or being executed, it's a pretty major thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, if somebody were telling us something that was genuinely controversial and it put them in jeopardy of their job, I would be as amenable and sympathetic to, you know, discretion as possible. But what happens, unfortunately, as a regularized bit of business in Washington is things that are being said that are not putting anybody's job in jeopardy they're forcing you to say administration official say as opposed to White House official. And that's just, there's no reason for that, frankly.
So to sum up, you think when a story is revelatory, that an anonymous source is very important and should be given the right to anonymity. But when it's used on a regular basis, that it's just become, it's gotten out of control.
It is. I think that's right. I think too much business in Washington today is done through this cloak of anonymity, where it serves nothing. Most people actually know who these people are on the daily, mm-hmm. you know, background briefings. You have ridiculous scenarios where a top official, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, you know, some other important official will get up in front of a room of 50 people. The briefing is transcribed, you know, there's a tape of this, and yet it's always referred to in the transcript as senior administration official. Everybody in Washington ultimately knows who this person is. The only person who doesn't know is the average reader.
So I think what you're saying is some of the official White House briefings have to be listed because the as anonymous.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They complain about anonymous sources, but they absolutely use them to their own advantage. And right now the White House Correspondents Association is raising you know, a campaign to try to convince the White House to do less and less of that. It's gotten out of control in the 5 years.
So you're trying to convince the White House to use less anonymous sources.
Absolutely. Absolutely, especially for the regularized everyday kind of stuff. You know, what happens is people in the White House will say, you know, on background, off the record, Bush is great. You know, we don't need that to be off the record on background. This should be preserved for situations of great sensitivity where either because of, say, you know, diplomatic relations or somebody's job is at stake. Those are the kinds of reasons where we ought to, you know, or we're imparting genuinely confidential information.
Yeah.
But most of the time, too often in Washington, it's actually just the normal course of business.
Well, that's right. I had someone say to me yesterday, on background, we have no comment.
Crazy. It's crazy.
Well, one last question. You're married. Was it good to be married and covering the same beat in Russia? Was it complicated to divide up the stories? Did that work out well?
Oh, it was very easy. Anything Susan wanted to cover, she would cover, and I would do everything else.
We're incredibly lucky to be able to work together. That's the way I look at it. And really, to be there, you're so far away. You're thousands of miles away. You're an 8-hour time difference. And, you know, I've been so blessed, really, to have a partner like Peter that we can share everything with and really have a back and forth going about everything. So that worked out well for the paper, and it enabled us to write this book, which also is a wonderful thing for us.
And we met at the Post. That's where we first got together. In fact, Susan was for a little while my editor, and we discovered that we work pretty well together. It's a nice, it's a blessing to have a kind of partnership that works both in personal and professional lives, and we hope to do it again.
So you don't believe in the kind of personnel rules that would require people who are working together to have one of them leave the organization if they were in love or married?
Well, I think what newspapers have found is they'd have a hard time having foreign correspondents if that were the case. It's a very, very demanding job. It's pretty much round the clock. And I think one of the ways we were able to do it is because we were married to each other. And actually, the Post has a number of married couples in their foreign bureaus, I think, for exactly that reason. It's just an incredibly demanding 24-hour-a-day job, really.
Well, it was great to talk with you both. Thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thank you. This was great.
Thank you. It was terrific.
Susan Glasser and Peter Baker are the authors of the new book, Kremlin Rising. They were the Washington Post's Moscow bureau chiefs from 2001 to 2004. She now covers terrorism for the Post. He covers the White House.